In his book on biblical characters, this is what Frederick Buechner writes about Adam. He let the times fall to the carpet beside him. It was the usual recital, a new tax plan, the danger of oral contraceptives to women over 40, the mayor's special committee on child abuse. He pushed his glasses back on his forehead and with his thumb and forefinger massaged the loose flesh under his eyes. Through the club window, he could see a fat woman in slacks waiting for a bus, a boy with a ponytail walking a dog. Somebody had the TV on in another room, and he could hear the rise and fall of canned laughter. He lit a cigarette and let the smoke drift out of his mouth without exhaling it. The city sky was turning brown with the approach of dusk. Then suddenly, as if it had been only yesterday, he remembered Eden. The leopard, the starling, the rose. He remembered giving each its name, remembered the green river, the shy green girl. He could no longer remember why it was he had felt compelled to leave it, except it had something to do with exerting his independence. Beyond that, he had only the dim sense that somehow a terrible injustice had been done, or possibly a terrible justice. He saw the flame of what must have been the sunset flash like a sword in the upper story windows across the street. When the old steward brought him his third martini, he called him Pete. Actually, his name was Angelo. Adam. And as someone said today, today is Women in Ministry or Women in the Life of the Church. Celebrate Women Day. So for equal opportunity, here's a little bit of Eve. Like Adam, she spent the rest of her days convincing herself it had all worked out for the best. It was only once in a while at night, just as she was going off to sleep with all her usual defenses down, that her mind drifted back to the days when, because there was nothing especially important to do, everything was especially important. When too good not to be true hadn't yet turned into too good to be true. When being alone was never the same as being lonely. Then sad and beautiful dreams overtook her, which she would wake from, homesick for a home she could no longer even name. Homesick. Homesick for Eden. Do you know what it's like to be homesick? Homesick is the kid on the second night of summer camp, lying in an unfamiliar cot, listening to the owls, longing for the security and protection of some place better known. Homesick is the freshman on the eve of fall break, wanting to be back in a setting where there are no midterm exams, no sloppy roommates, just familiar faces and home-cooked meatloaf. Homesick was my mother on her wedding night. At least, that's what she confessed Thursday over dinner, 60 years later. By the time she was 16 years old, she had already lived in 16 different houses. Grandpa traveled a lot. But the first time she was ever homesick was the first night she was away from her parents' home. We know how it feels. It's the risk of stepping out beyond familiar landscapes, dependable relationships, and recognizable food. Remember back to the time when you felt its pangs. Chances are, in that is a glimmer of what it's like to be homesick for the Garden of Eden. Now, this ancient story we hear again was written down by people most likely far from home. I hope you don't think for a minute it was an eyewitness account. Oh no. Language hadn't been invented yet, much less pens or computers or journals. Adam and Eve are remembered centuries later by people who had nearly forgotten the Garden of Eden. Some scholars think maybe during the time of King Solomon, evidence maybe the story was edited in the years after the Babylonian exile. And that's interesting because that's when Jews lived in a foreign land. And one way they could make sense of their homesickness was by remembering Adam and Eve. Now, most of the time, when we remember Adam and Eve, we remember the forbidden fruit, the talking snake, the taking of what they were told not to take, the hiding, the blaming. But frankly, among the Jews, the rabbis have never spent much time revisiting that part of the story. They knew they had already been expelled from the garden, and now they had to make their way through the world with the knowledge of good and evil. It was Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, who said that this is what makes human beings different from other animals. We have the capacity to make moral choices. And we have to make the choices because it's no longer Eden where all the choices were made for us. Maybe, as some of the Jewish sages have suggested, Eden was never intended as the long-term home. After all, goes the reasoning, if God did not want us to make choices, then God would have implanted an obedience chip in our hardware, and we would be good robots who colored within the lines and always did what was respected. There's a story then that Bill Moyers tells. He says, my mother used to leave her freshly baked sugar cookies right in the middle of the table, warm and inviting, but forbidden until supper was over. If she meant the temptation to be a test of discipline to build character, my brother and I usually flunked. I think of this when I hear the story of the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. Why didn't God place the forbidden fruit on the very top branch, beyond the reach of obedience? Truth is, we make choices all the time, you and I. Sometimes by animal impulse rather than logic or congruity or faithfulness. Consequently, once again, we'll find ourselves far from home. The ancient story speaks of this. God gives us room to choose between good and evil. There is no heavenly hovering, no warning sirens when we get too close. God entrusts us with the ability to make good decisions. And whether or not every decision is good, it comes with natural consequences. So the Lord declares, Adam, so you want to go it alone? Well, here's the hoe, there are the fields. Eve, you thought you could be fruitful by yourself? Well, guess up. You're about to get fruitful and childbirth will be no picnic. Up until then, she hasn't had to worry about that. Life outside of Eden is going to be a lot of hard work. So this isn't the biology story, and this isn't the science story. This is a diagnosis of our human condition. We are given great choices in great freedom, and they all come with consequences. More important than finding in the story some philosophical notion of original sin as our genetic condition, there is here, I think, a residual homesickness. We have all these choices. That's what makes us human. and yet we also long to be united with God, that's the homesickness. Jesus points the way. As we heard in the gospel story, he is pushed by the Holy Spirit to enter the desolation of the wilderness. No other distractions except the distractions in his own spirit. And in his humanity, he has to make his way through a series of risky decisions. The tempter comes and plays on his divinity and says, "Well, why don't you turn these stones into bread?" Not only could he satisfy his own hungry belly after 40 days of fasting, he could then use the trick to feed multitudes of hungry peasants. But he knows this is not the path for him, for we do not live by bread alone, but by the word that God speaks. In another moment, he is tempted to impress the crowds, to win them over by leaping from the topmost place of the Jerusalem temple, to do a swan dive in public and command the angels to catch him. It says that in Psalm 91, you know. But he knows his way forward is not the way of being impressive. It is the way of self-sacrifice and self-giving all the way to the cross and through the cross. So he rejects the temptation to be impressive. And then there's the third temptation. In the twinkling of an eye, if only Jesus will bow down to a foreign power, he will gain authority over all the nations. Without any cross, without any suffering, he could win over every heart and bend every knee. All it takes is for him to give in to the devil. And this is not the way of God either. You love God and you love God alone. So Jesus chooses that. The right decisions take wisdom. They require clarity, and then they need courage. Because the only way forward is forward. If there is a longing for Eden, it's not really going to be helpful if it's nostalgia, because nostalgia is a big fat trick. No, the longing for Eden is a desire to be restored and brought back to God. If it's to be at peace with God and then at peace with one another. And I think there's no greater peace than to stand before God guilt-free and say, "Here is my life. These are the decisions I have made. I could do no other. I own them. I offer them as the best acts of faithfulness I can do. God, finish and heal what I cannot." That's why the table of Christ is such a compelling invitation to us today. It is a way station on the road back home when all will be restored. When the New Jerusalem comes down for us as a gift, it will come not because we're righteous, not because we're good, not because we have everything figured out, but because God is better at goodness and righteousness and figuring things out than we can ever be. And God is so good to stay with us and stay after that us, even until that final day appears. Did you, in fact, notice the end of the garden story? I was well into my 30s before I heard what my Sunday school teachers neglected to point out. They were so insistent on talking about don't eat the apple, don't disobey, don't do this, don't do that, that they forgot to point out that after Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden, God stitches their first set of clothes. Can't go walking out there in those stupid little fig tree branches anymore. So God says, "Here's some real clothes." That's unexpected grace. They don't always have to fend for themselves. They will be provided for. and the grace continues through the ages. Even to this day, as God keeps speaking, and God offers more guidance after that very first commandment was ignored. For we do not live by bread alone, but by the word that God still speaks. I'll bet you even know the very last words God will speak. Welcome home.